Hi friends, welcome back to another episode of Colts, Killers, and Cocktails with Jen and Vanessa.
Please be advised, the following episode is for mature audiences only. We talk about content that may be triggering to some individuals and contain discussions regarding rape, murder, sex, suicide, religious organizations, and disturbing situations.
Now, let's get into this week's episode. To another episode of Colts, Killers, and Cocktails. I'm your host, Vanessa.
And I'm your host, Jen.
And we are back after our month hiatus, like we always are.
We promise eventually we're going to get better. In our defense today, there was a bike race.
There was a bike race.
And it was extremely hard to get to my apartment.
It's still going on, and they're acting like they're racing for their lives.
I think they kind of are.
I think they kind of are, too. But it makes me a little nervous because they're all, like, in a straight line. So if one of them falls down, it's going to be, like, a domino effect.
Right.
It's scary.
So, yeah. Mass Ave Crit at its finest every single year.
Are we ready to just dive on into it? We got to go to a Colts game in a little bit.
We do. So. We have preseason tickets. Thank goodness. So, all right. Let's do it. So, last week, we left off with our favorite person, Adolfo. And the last thing that he said was that he wanted to sacrifice an American because they would be weak and they would be able to express their pain clearly, because in that way, the more pain and the more, you know, grieving that they go through, the more powerful the sacrifice.
Yeah, because I remember, like, all of these, like, animals, and, like, the rooster was worth, like, X amount, but then, like, a baby cub was worth, like, $1 million or something like that.
Right, exactly.
Okay, gotcha.
So now we're going to talk about this American sacrifice, which literally leads to the downfall of this cult. So Mark Kilroy was born on March 5th, 1968 in Chicago, but when he was very young, his parents moved to Texas. He was known as the athletic person in, you know, middle school and high school, extremely intelligent. He was your all-American college student. He was 21 years old. He was studying pre-med at the University of Texas, and his dream was to become a medical doctor. His friends would describe him as friendly, outgoing, just like a really nice guy and a really good Christian. He was really strong in his faith. In 1989, in March, it was second semester, and it's spring break, of course, so everyone in college wants to go somewhere that's kind of close, but, you know, far enough away and just go party.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're in Texas, like, they're already south, so where are they going to go?
So there is a place called South Padre Island, and it was pretty close to the university. Pretty much everyone would spring break there, and it's on the border between Texas and Mexico.
Okay, I've heard of there.
Yeah, and you're still near the water. There's fun bars. You know, in Mexico, the drinking age is lower, so a lot of people would go there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cheaper.
Yeah.
So on March 11th, 1989, Mark Kilroy and his friends, again, went to South Padre Island with college friends as well. They were hitting up the beach, bar hopping, and at night they would usually cross into the border of Mexico, Matamoros to be exact, because there were tons of dive bars and cheap drinks. So people would stay in the U.S. side, walk over to Matamoros at night, and then go back and walk back to the U.S.
That sounds so much fun.
Oh, yeah. Like, I would have totally done this in college.
For sure. Oh, I would do that now. What are you talking about?
Maybe not after the end of this story.
Oh, God. Okay.
So, you know, things are going as planned. People are, you know, going to the beach during the day, drinking at night. And on the second night of their trip, Mark just vanished. They had been in Matamoros that night, drinking at all the bars. He fell behind on foot from his friends, which you never do if you're drinking. You always have that buddy that you stay with the entire time.
Yeah, don't leave your friends, people.
But I think men a lot, you know, girls, we are always in pairs. We go to the bathroom together. We do everything together. I think, like, a lot of men just leave their buddies and be like, he's fine, he'll catch up. That same night, Adolfo sent out his crew to find an American because, again, they know that there's a ton of Americans on spring break and a lot of them like to come to Matamoros at night, so it's an easy snatch. They waited for the Americans to get drunk and then they would try to kidnap them. That night in particular, there were about 15,000 tourists in Matamoros from the U.S.
That's a pretty big amount because it's not a very big town, right?
No. So, I mean, a lot of people just cross over because, again, it's spring break. And they always know this. The locals know this. So, two of Adolfo's followers closed in on Mark Kilroy when he fell behind his group, like we said earlier, and they asked him if he wanted a ride. At this point, he's extremely drunk. It's early in the morning. So, he agrees. You know, who wouldn't want a ride?
Right.
And they put him in his truck, in their truck, and then on the way to drop them off near the bridge to the U.S. side, they're like, sorry, buddy, we need to stop at one bar really quick. So as soon as they stop at the bar, This makes Mark extremely nervous. He jumps out of the vehicle and just starts sprinting towards the U.S. side.
Good, Mark. Good. Run.
Then, and again, just remember, he is drunk at this time. He heard freeze, you know, and he thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to get arrested for public intox. There's probably cops around because it's right next to the border. If I'm near the border and I hear freeze, I'm going to stop.
Yeah, I'm going to freeze.
So when he did that, they took him, put him back in his truck, in their truck, and tied him up.
What slimy little slimes.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So they abducted Mark. They took him back to the ranch where, you know, they had sacrificed people before, but Adolfo wasn't there. So they left him in the truck for a full day. And again, this is Mexico, so it's very hot outside. It's March at this time. They didn't give him water, food, or anything.
I'm surprised he didn't die of heat exhaustion.
I'm honestly surprised he survived that, too. So even his last day of life was not a great one. The caretaker at the facility took pity on him. He didn't believe, you know, in the Palomayombo stuff that's going on. So while everyone was out doing other things, he fed him scrambled eggs and water.
I mean, it's not great.
But I know. I would rather have a burger, but, you know, I'm sure I'd be thankful for scrambled eggs.
Yeah. Like, did you put any salt and pepper on them either?
Right. Or cheese. I love cheese on scrambled eggs.
So good.
So when Adolfo comes back, he sees Mark and he gets super excited. As soon as he sees them, he points right towards the shed and they take Mark into the shed, as they had done to many others before. Mark was sodomized and then he was castrated while he was still alive. And then he was sacrificed to the Nanga. Specifically, his brain was the first thing to be sacrificed because Adolfo said he's a smart American, so this is going to transfer to the Nanga and then help protect us. Then the rest of the group dismembered parts of his body, like cutting off his legs and ripping out his spine. And this, of course, was after he was dead.
Yeah, I would hope that they're not just going to try to do that.
And then they buried the body in a shallow grave. And after that, they went out to eat burgers and fries, just like they always did after every ritual.
So they feed him scrambled eggs, and they get burgers and fries.
I mean, they didn't even feed him. It was the caretaker that wasn't even part of their group that took pity on him.
Okay. Burgers and fries. Wow.
Yeah. So that was one of the things that they always did.
Okay.
Of course, at this point, Mark's friends have no idea where he is. So they went to the authorities to conduct a search. At this point, Mark was one of 60 people that had disappeared in the first 3 months in Matamoros in 1989.
One of 60?
One of 60. But the reason that his case got so much attention was because his uncle, Ken Kilroy, worked at U.S. Customs, so of course he used his connections to help get this case moving. A police task force was made to find him, and the Mexican Federal Police Department was involved as well. They started working on questioning witnesses and informants. However, they were having problems getting to any conclusions because there was just nothing connecting him. They even tried to hire a hypnotist to find clues, which of course went nowhere, but they assumed it was something, you know, with the drug smuggling that was going on around there.
Right.
They started searching for his body in the Rio Grande River, but again, no body was found. People from his hometown in Texas even flocked over to Matamoros to create a search party. Then on April 1st, 1989, authorities saw a vehicle fly through a roadblock because they set one up to catch drug smugglers without stopping. So, of course, they followed the vehicle, and this vehicle just so happened to belong to one of Adolfo's followers, all the way out to the ranch where they murdered Mark.
They saw the police following them, and they drove out to the ranch.
So that's the funny thing. All of them think we have the Nanga protecting us. And Adolfo can, you know, create magic. And he told them before, like, you never need to worry about police. Like, I can make you invisible. Remember, he was promising that to the drug lords and everything. So they're like, this is no problem. There's no way that they can come to the ranch.
Yeah, the police is just turning right when I'm turning right and doing a U-ey when I'm doing a U-ey. I'm invisible, though, so it's fine.
Yeah. So at this point, they see the ranch. They see him go into the ranch, and they're like, we're not going to go in there yet. We want to gather more information and figure out, first of all, why this guy flung through this checkpoint. And then why is he at this ranch? So they start talking to people that lived around the area, and they found out that a lot of people had recently been disappearing at the ranch. On April 9th, the police department went out to the ranch, and they arrested four followers. They arrested Hernandez Garcia, Hernandez Rivera, and then cult members Serena Valdez and Sergio Salinas. They also arrested the ranch's caretaker, Domingo Bustamante. Everyone from the group, though, was super relaxed because, again, the magic is going to protect them. The caretaker, though, however, was not a believer. And as soon as he was questioned, he identified Mark Kilroy to the police and told them that the group took him to the shack, and after that, he had no idea what happened. Garcia confessed to the police that many people had been killed at the ranch because of orders of Adolfo Constanzo. Because, again, they think even if they tell the truth, there's not going to be anything bad that happens to them. Garcia was so confident, he actually ended up taking the police to the exact spot where Mark Kilroy was buried. It was easy to see because they had put wires by the grave, so then that way, as soon as his body was done decomposing, they would be able to lift the wires and be able to gather his bones for a ritual because they could use it for a necklace to ward off danger.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Again, they're at the ranch. The police took the rest of the cult members there, forced them to dig up graves of everyone that they had murdered, and they found 15 mutilated bodies of males over the period of 9 months. 15 people over 9 months.
Where were the... So...
They just dug shallow graves all around the ranch. And that's where they were burying all these people.
So what about... You said that he was one of 60 people. They found 15.
They found 15 there. 60 probably was just with drug smugglers. Like, okay. You know, like random...
15 people for the sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So they were able to identify Mark Kilroy's remains with his teeth through dental records, thank goodness. So then at least his family knew what happened to him. Most of the other bodies, though, were from rival drug members from, like, different groups that either had, you know, issues with Adolfo, so he would take them out that way. Police also seized cocaine, 12 firearms, 11 vehicles, and also the Nanga. Inside the Nanga, they found human brains, a goat head, chicken feet, a turtle, several herbs, a horseshoe, coins, and, of course, animal blood.
Can you imagine, like, your child is going off for spring break, he's in medical school, he's trying to make the best of his life, and then he's found on a ranch.
Brutally sacrificed. For nothing.
I can't imagine.
Yeah. So, of course, after this, the police are focusing on, we need to find Adolfo and the rest of these members.
For sure.
On April 11th, which is when they went to the ranch to go dig up the rest of the bodies, Adolfo catches wind of this, and he flees with a few of his members, and they flee to Mexico City because he had an apartment there. U.S. and Mexican law enforcement started a manhunt for the group, but they were searching like Illinois, Miami, because rumors were just flying everywhere of people being like, I saw him in different sightings. On April 17th, one of the followers, his name was Serafan, was arrested in Houston for importing drugs, and they were like, well, since he's in Houston, he has to be kind of close to Adolfo. He has to be at least somewhere in this area. Meanwhile, in Mexico City, police noticed that the killings in Matamoros actually had a lot of similarities to murders that happened in 1987 and 1989 when Adolfo lived there. They started talking to local witches just to talk about, you know, the different types of killings and why people were killed that way. And they found out that he was hiding in Mexico City through that.
Nice.
Yeah. So on May 6, 1988... the police centered in on his apartment where he was hiding. Adolfo freaked out. He threw gold coins and paper money in the streets to try to cause a distraction, and then he opened fire on the officers. After a 45-minute return of fire, Adolfo was desperate, and seeing that the police were closing in on him, he ordered his followers to kill him, and then said that they needed to create a suicide pact, and then everyone kill each other after that.
So this is another Jonestown.
Pretty much. He said everything was lost and no one had the right to have his money. Then, after that happened, De Leon did as he was told, and he shot Adolfo twice in the chest. However, his followers had seen a lot of things happen in the spanning days, so they decided to not follow through with the suicide pact.
Good. Good for them.
Yeah. So, of course, after that, everyone was arrested, and on May 3rd, 1994, one of the women was sentenced to 62 years in prison. Other cult members were sentenced to 67 years each. Their charges were multiple homicide, which you get 31 years for, possession of narcotics, which you get 12 years for, involvement in organized crime, which is 5 years, police impersonation, from when they told Mark to freeze, 2 years, illegal body desecration, 2 years, illegal possession of firearms, which is 10 years, and illegal possession of weapons exclusive to the Mexican army, which is 5 years. The woman I mentioned before, she did not have that, so that's why her sentence was a little bit lower.
Still, she'll most likely spend the rest of her life in prison.
Correct. However, on March 27th, 1998, the Mexican federal court reduced everyone's sentences by 17 years. So instead of 67 years, they had 50 total, which is very, very common.
Why did they
in their court
that?
System? A lot of people appeal, you know, different sentencing. So that's the story of Mark Kilroy. His parents have, of course, went through the most horrific thing that they could even go through. Mm-hmm. They decided to establish a foundation in his name called the Mark Kilroy Foundation. It was established in May of 1989, so right after this happened, by his parents Jim and Helen Kilroy. So the reason that they established this foundation was because during the 4 weeks it took to figure out what happened to Mark, and during the search and after the discovery of Mark, they received thousands and thousands of letters from people talking about the destruction that drugs have caused in their lives. So they decided to establish this foundation in order to unite organizations and people living in the community for the prevention of substance abuse and education and rehabilitation for substance abuse.
Aww.
So at least they were doing something positive with the pain that they were suffering.
Right.
But yeah.
And so it's some way to honor his memory.
It is. Know? It's a great way to honor his memory.
Make people not forget about him and make people say, hey, this is who he was.
Yeah. So that's the story of the Matamoros cult and what caused their downfall, which was messing with Mark Kilroy.
Oh my gosh. Well, it was a very good story. I appreciate you telling it, but I'm glad that we are done with that because I'm done with the human sacrifice. I'm done with the animal sacrifice.
Me too. I'm ready just for like a regular chill cult that just wants to like dance in a field or something.
Like, what was that one that was like they wanted to grow their own food or something?
Oh, yeah. They were great.
Yeah.
We need to find one like that. We need a happy one.
Next time.
I agree.
One that like worships cats or something. Let's do that.
I'm sure there's one out there.
There probably is one out there.
So, right. Do you want to tell us what we're drinking tonight?
Yes. We are drinking cherry eyeball juice because it is almost spooky season.
I cannot wait for spooky season.
So, this drink in it has rum. We use Bacardi rum. You can use vodka instead, though. So you put about 1.5 ounces of rum. You put, probably fill it up about halfway with tart cherry juice. And then put about maybe like 1/4 of orange juice and then top it up with soda water. So it's rum, cherry juice, orange juice, and soda water. Shake it all together. We made some eyeballs from Lychees, L-Y-C-H-E-E, Lychees, Lychees, and blackberries, but the eyeballs didn't really turn out very good, and honestly, if anybody's pupil looks like a blackberry, I think they need to go to the emergency room like yesterday. So
I agree with that.
It was a little terrifying, but
it's very refreshing. It tastes like grape juice almost, you know?
Yeah.
Like the Welch's grape juice with a kick.
It's pretty dangerous, and I never knew that cherry juice and orange juice went so well together.
And there's actually a lot of benefits with cherry juice, too.
Do you have benefits of cherry juice for us?
Yep, so according to Google search, what happens if you drink cherry juice? It helps improve memory and brain health, and also it helps recovery with post-exercise, because it's naturally high in potassium.
Really?
Yep.
How so fun. What's the benefit of rum?
Happiness.
Calm. Tranquility. I like that. Okay.
Yep. All right.
So this would be a great like bonfire drink, or
this would be an amazing bonfire drink.
Uh-huh. Or like if you have a Halloween party or something like that.
Or this could go well with cheese. But I think everything goes well with cheese.
Everything goes good with cheese.
But for sure chocolate.
Oh god. So good with chocolate.
Yeah.
I agree.
So what story do you have for us this week?
So, okay. Have you heard of Richard Mark Evonitz?
No.
Okay. So his last name is Evonitz. So I think that's Evonitz.
I agree.
It sounds good. Okay. So when I write these stories or research these cases, I go through them and I kind of just make sure that, you know, I don't repeat too many words over and over again. Like the word moist, like I don't say it like 17 times.
Please just don't say the word moist.
Moist, moist, moist. But when I was rereading this case and checking for any errors, I told Jen that I started crying like halfway through it. And so today, we're not going to have any tears. We're going to get through this without crying. So if that tells you what kind of case we're doing today. So here we go. We're going to jump on our airplane time machine, and we're going to travel back to June of 2002 to the city of Columbia, South Carolina. And just to make you all feel old, we are closer to the year 2040 than we are to 2002.
Stop.
You're welcome. 15-year-old Kara Robinson is about to enter her junior year of high school at White Knoll High School. She is 5'4", and she has blonde hair, blue eyes, and she's slim built. She had a high school sweetheart named Chris Putnam, and they were inseparable. It was her first love, goo goo gaga over each other. But she wasn't like a girly girl. People would always say that she was so beautiful, she should have been in pageants. And she was like, no, screw that. I want to play sports and be active, which I agree with her. Again, it's the summer before junior year, so this is the time that everyone is about to be getting their licenses, or they already have them. And you probably remember when you were 16 and your friends or yourself were getting their licenses. Like, you felt on top of the world and so free.
That was great, except I had to share a car with my twin. But other than that, it was still great.
But your twin's great.
So. Oh, yeah, and we all went to the same places, so it was fine.
Katie. Like, okay, but when you're doing that, like, you're invincible, you do whatever you want.
You have a newfound freedom.
Yeah, like, you can even go to the video store, whatever, take back a movie. But Kara's friend, Heather, had just gotten her license. Heather's parents had a lake house, and Heather asked if her and Kara could drive up one weekend, like, be super free. And her mom says yes, but you know parents with their chores, and she basically said, yes, but there are a few chores that need to be done around the house before you girls leave.
Like every mom does.
Like every mom does. Like, I wasn't even allowed to get my license until 3 months after my birthday because my quote-unquote room wasn't clean.
That's hilarious.
That's, now it is. Back then, 16-year-old
it's life-ending.
Was not okay with it. So one of the chores was to water the flowers in the yard. Kara and Heather are just so stoked that her mom says yes, and Kara's mom had given her permission too. So they're trying to be independent and get the heck out of town. So Kara says, listen, you go finish getting ready for our trip. I'll water your flowers in your yard, and that way we can leave way sooner. So Heather agrees, and she had to go take a shower, so she goes and hops in the shower. When Heather comes out in the yard 15 minutes later, Kara's gone, but it was weird because the hose was still running on the ground. Maybe she had to go inside and use the bathroom real quick. That's what Heather was thinking. So Heather checks inside, and Kara isn't there, but her purse and shoes are still there. Immediately, Heather calls her mom and becomes hysterical because she's scared for her friend. Her mom says, calm down, I'm sure she just ran home on foot or something because she forgot something for your trip. So Heather's mom calls Kara's mom and says, hey, is Kara with you or has she come home because she's missing from our house? Well, Kara's mom is at work, and so she's like, what do you mean she's missing? Like, I gave her permission to go with your daughter. What do you mean she's gone?
Right.
So she calls the police, and they come over, and they get a description of her and everything, and they are not the best cops. And they say the typical response.
Wait 48 hours? She probably ran away?
Go home and wait and see if she calls you. She's an upset teenager. So Kara's mom is pissed, and she's numb. She says, quote, I was sitting there waiting for her to call, and you want to think that she's down the road or at another friend's house, but you know that she's not. She knew that because Kara would not just walk away. She's not that type of person. It's just like poop. She disappeared out of thin air. This was not the first time a weird, weird instance like this had occurred. So let's get in that airplane time machine again, and we're going to go back 5 years to Spotsylvania, Pennsylvania, on September 9th, 1996. Which, isn't that just such a fun name?
Spotsylvania, Pennsylvania.
Oh,
rolls off the tongue.
I like that, but it sounds like a Spotsylvania, like a Dracula type thing. But just a little background on Spotsylvania. It was a typical sleepy small town where crime didn't happen. Children played wherever they wanted in the neighborhood without a care in the world. On that day, September 9th, police get a phone call from a concerned mother about her missing daughter. Sophia Silva was 15 years old. Just a couple of fun facts about Sophia. She had beautiful, super dark curly hair. She loved to laugh. She ran track, and she was very athletic. She had brown eyes. She had braces, and she loved the color purple. Like, I'm pretty sure in the picture I saw of her, she had a purple shirt on. And at that time, her nails and her toenails were painted purple.
Wow.
Like, she was a purple monster. So she had just returned home from school one day, and she grabbed a grape soda from the fridge, also purple, and said, Mom, I'm going to go on the front porch, listen to the radio, and do my homework. But hours passed, and she hadn't come back inside yet, so her mom came outside to check on her, and she was gone. Her book bag and her soda were still there, and the radio was still playing. And I'm getting kind of like goody two-shoes vibes from Sophia. She never came home late, she never went off without saying something. She was super responsible, hence coming home and doing her homework right away. Family and friends went door to door, and there were no signs of her. Police were called, and they checked out the scene, and they did not see any signs of foul play. But there were no screams heard, no cars sped off, nothing, as if she had just vanished again. The next day, the police went all out and created, like, a search squad. They had helicopters, they had a ground search, they were checking the woods, they even had divers go into a local lake. Like, they weren't messing around, they were doing the whole nine yards. But it was no use. Hours turned into days, which turned into weeks. There was just no sign of Sophia. On October 14th, 1996, 1 month and 5 days later after her disappearance, a harrowing call comes in from the neighboring county. In a heavily wooded creek bend, a maintenance manager of King George County, Gary Norman, spotted a big bundle of something that was wrapped in a blue moving blanket tied with a rope. Sticking out of the big old load of the blanket were toes that had purple toenail polish on it.
Yeah.
They knew it was Sophia. Dental records confirmed it was her, and everyone was shocked. They were crying. They were heartbroken. Things like this didn't happen in Spotsylvania. And just a little bit more of a cringy fact, the way that her clothes were on her body, officers could tell that she had been undressed and then dressed again.
Right.
I don't know how they can tell that. Probably, like, something was crooked or it was, like, misbuttoned or something like that. The medical examiner couldn't get an exact cause of death as her body was, like, that decomposed. However, they said that the body was there for 4 or 5 weeks, and so that means, like, she was only held captive for, like, 1 or 2 days.
Right.
So police think, okay, we need to go back to the beginning, to the day that Sophia disappeared. Since no one heard screaming, there was no sign of a struggle, that points to the fact that maybe Sophia willingly left with her killer. Like, maybe she knew them. Neighbors were interviewed, and one name kept coming up like a broken record, Carl Rausch. So Carl was a 44-year-old handyman who had a criminal record and just not a good reputation in the area. He was kind of known as the neighborhood creep. He was known to drive around in an old van and look at women and kids.
I would say that classifies as a creep, yeah.
That is a creep. But why are these towns letting these neighborhood creeps, like, remember Ed Gein?
Yeah.
How they're like, oh, he's just a town weirdo.
He's
like,
harmless. No, he's not, obviously.
No, obviously not. So, a few neighbors said that they had seen Sophia and Carl talking a few days before her disappearance. So, police say, that's a little sus. And they go to interview Carl. He obviously denies everything. He says, oh, I don't know her. I've never seen her. Yada, yada. Carl is asked to take a lie detector test and refuses, which, I mean, I would too. So, I can't say anything about that. But investigators were able to obtain a search warrant for this van with all these neighbors' testimony against him. They were like, that's enough evidence. They took carpet fibers and hair from the vehicle, and while searching, they found purple flakes on the carpet, which, again, she was Purple Girl. She was wearing purple nail polish. They sent in the flakes, fibers, and hair off to the crime lab to compare the items at the scene, like with Carl's and hers, and the results come in, and they were a match.
Awesome.
So, slam dunk, case closed, easy. And Carl is indicted for murder and kidnapping. But here's a fun fact. Carl was actually about to start serving a year sentence in jail for a federal shoplifting offense. So until police had 1,000,000% evidence that Carl did kill Sophia, they were like, we're just going to let him sit in jail for a little bit, and we're going to get as much evidence as possible, then we're going to charge him with murder.
I think that's a great plan.
Yeah. So with Carl in jail, the police start gathering even more evidence against him. The community was at ease. Their sleepy little town was safe again. The small town wouldn't be at ease for long. On May 31st, 1997, about 8.5 months after Sophia was reported missing, Spotsylvania police get a call from Ron Lisk, a concerned father reporting that he could not locate his 15-year-old daughter Kristen and his 12-year-old daughter Katie. He came home from work and the girls would beat him home from school, but they were old enough to stay by themselves for a little bit. So he was like, okay, like, I'll be home soon. When he came home on this specific day, he found their backpacks in the yard and the front door was open. They also had, like, one of those baby pools for hot summer days, and the girls liked hanging out in it sometimes. So they had gotten the pool out and the hose was still running, and, like, the pool was overflowing by this point.
Right.
So he walks in the house and their alarm system was disarmed, a quirk about Kristen is that she always had a glass of chocolate milk after school. Like, that was her jam. And so there was a full glass of chocolate milk on the counter, and it was untouched. So police come out and they search and search, but there was nothing. No signs of foul play, no signs of abduction, nada. There's just nothing, just like Sophia. Investigators are feeling some real deja vu here. Just like with Sophia's case, the whole nine yards is out. Helicopters, dogs, divers, everything, they had to find them. This can't end like Sophia. Unfortunately, 5 days later, some highway workers about 40 miles away thought they saw some mannequins floating in the water below, but they called the police just in case. We know it's never a mannequin.
No.
It was Kristen and Katie. The medical examiner could not tell the cause of death, but it was either being smothered or they had drowned. Investigators, again, they're feeling deja vu. This is too similar to Sophia's case to ignore. The red flags are waving in their faces. But here's the thing. Carl's still in jail for that shoplifting charge.
Right, so it can't be him.
It's not him. But investigators are feeling sick. Like, they had to have missed something. And they had sent those lab tests out, and it was a match. So they're like, we're going to, you know, send out the fibers and hair found on the sisters just in case we miss something. So they send that back to the lab. They send Sophia stuff back to the lab. They send Carl stuff back to the lab, like, just to get everything retested. So here's the thing. The second analysis said that the evidence did not match. None of it did.
So did someone mess with the first test results?
Not necessarily. The state examiner had made a huge mistake. She had originally had such tunnel vision on this case from her small hometown, she fudged the test and said they matched because she wanted to solve the crime so badly.
That is horrible. I hope she got fired.
That's not how you solve a crime.
No, you're literally mishandling evidence. That's a crime. You're literally creating a crime to quote-unquote solve a crime.
Exactly. Well, she did get fired. So I feel no sympathy for her. Like, goodbye.
No, she got what was coming to her.
Yeah. That was awful. Investigators feel gut-punched. The families feel gut-punched. The community feels gut-punched. And, I mean, investigators had to come out and say that they accused an innocent man of murder. They don't know who the killer is, and we are back to square one. So, a serial killer is on the loose. The community was terrified again. Kids weren't playing in their yards anymore unsupervised. There was a total loss of safety. The Silva-Lisk Task Force was formed, which, again, were the victims' last names. Investigators from Spotsylvania were communicating with officers all over the country, but no one else had anything strange like this. These were unique cases that weren't really happening anywhere else. Months had turned into years. Investigators' worst fears were confirmed. Unless this monster of a human committed this act again, they simply had nothing in these cases to connect anything. So, airplane time machine, we're going to jump back in. And we're going to go back to 5 years later in summer of 2002, where we started this story. Now, again, Kara's disappearance occurred in Columbia, South Carolina. This is hundreds of miles away from Spotsylvania. While Kara was outside watering the flowers, because again, she was helping Heather with her chore so they could drive up to the lake quicker, she saw a green Trans Am drive by. And that car was like the shit back in the day. Like, that was like today's Tesla.
Right.
So she's thinking, I like that car. I wish I could have one like that. But, I mean, really didn't think anything else of it. Like, basically, like, cool car. Well, this car circles back a couple of minutes later and actually pulls into Heather's driveway. And, you know, she didn't think anything was too weird about it. The guy got out of the car, and he just looked like your everyday average Joe. He was clean cut. He had a baseball cap on, but it didn't cover his eyes. Just your everyday average middle-class white American male. Which I say those are the people you should fear the most sometimes.
That and pillars of the community.
Oh, pillars of the community, for sure. The guy comes up to her and he has some magazines in his hands because, you know, early 2000s. And he says, hey, I've got these magazines to distribute to the neighbors. Are your parents home? And she's like, well, this is my friend's house, so you'll just have to come back later or something. And he says, oh, no worries at all. Are your friend's parents home? I can give these to them instead. And she responds, not at the moment. They're both at work. At first, they were kind of like at normal conversational pace, like distance from each other. And as soon as she said that her parents weren't home, he steps closer, he pulls out a gun, and he holds it to her neck. He says, "If you scream, I'm going to shoot you. Don't struggle, don't fight, don't make any noise. Walk with me to my car." She complies, and he opens the back seat, and she sees one of those, like, large Rubbermaid tote containers.
Yeah.
And the next two words she hears are, "Get in." So, this shit stain who made a 15-year-old girl get in a rubber tote was not Carl Rausch. This man ended up being Richard Mark Ivanitz, like I said at the beginning. So, who is Richard Mark Ivanitz? He was born on July 29th, 1963, to Joe and Tess, and he's the oldest of two sisters. There was a disturbing event from his childhood where he choked out his sister on Christmas Eve, like, to the point where she was unconscious for no reason. And, I mean, it's not really just a kids being kids thing in this situation, because you should never choke anybody to the point where they're unconscious.
I totally agree.
Right. So, one of his sisters quoted, quote, "We lived in a prison. Joe, their dad, was a very controlling person. He wanted us to make straight A's. If we didn't, we were stupid. It was all about power and control. He said, you'll get an A or you'll get a beating. I see him as a sadistic man who got pleasure. I know I saw the pleasure in his face out of making us miserable." Well, I guess this fear inspired Richard because he graduated high school at age 16. A couple of years later, at age 20, he wrote a fake check, which is weird because my sources called it a rubber check.
I've never heard of that before.
I guess it makes sense, like bounce back.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just like a 90s term, I don't know. But he wrote it at Kmart, which was a huge crime in the back in the day. Like, you can't do that. After that, since his dad was so strict, he said, "You can either get the fuck out of my house or you can join the Navy." So he chose option B and he joins the Navy. Let's just say that the Navy did not make him a more moral person. On January 3rd, 1987, Richard was caught pulling up next to a 15-year-old, and she was walking her 3-year-old sister down the street, and he started masturbating. Well, obviously, the mother and child filed a police report, and police caught him shortly after, and he literally told the police, "I have a problem masturbating in front of girls, but, like, I was drunk, so I'm gonna plead no contest."
Are you serious?
Which, again, just as a reminder, pleading no contest basically means that he accepts conviction, but he does not plea or admit any guilt. So the Navy sent him to an alcohol rehab program where he was diagnosed with alcohol abuse. That's not where you should be sending him. You should be sending him to jail for masturbating in front of a 15 and 3-year-old child.
Right.
He would then re-enlist in the Navy for 3 more years.
How did they let him back in?
I have no idea how that happened.
Probably just because he showed he completed treatment.
Probably, and he's a better person after completing treatment. But before he was able to complete his 3-year term, he was honorably discharged. And I have no idea why, I have no idea how, I couldn't find anything. But he was honorably discharged. He received the Navy Achievement Medal for Leadership, Navy Good Conduct Medal, 2 Coast Guard Unit ribbons, a sea service deployment ribbon, and a National Defense Service Medal after, you know, his crime.
Great.
Great. After all his trophies and awards, he moved to Spotsylvania, where he worked at Kaiser Compressors. And shocking, not shocking, women at work avoided him because of his tasteless jokes. He was reported to only talk to women in degrading ways and to have anger management issues while employed at the company. But now he is in Spotsylvania. A few years later, he would move to Columbia, South Carolina, where, of course, he was near Kara. So Kara's in the backseat of this car in a rubber tote. Her hands are cuffed, her legs are tied with a rope, and she has a mouth gag in. But this badass was not giving up. She said, quote, "I knew he had intentions of kidnapping and keeping me. I had a pretty good suspicion. People don't kidnap young girls to take them to the park or to do anything nice. I knew he was going to sexually assault me, and I knew he was going to keep me for a while. But I knew I was smart, and I knew I was going to be able to outsmart him some way. There was not a question in my mind." So while she's in the fetal position in this tote, she was reading and memorizing the serial number on the inside of it.
Good job.
Can you, like, how smart is she at 15 years old to do that? So they drove for a while, and then they came to a stop. With the lid still on, she feels herself being dragged, and she would be dragged into this apartment. He then takes her out of the tote. She looks at her surroundings, and she remembers taking everything in. There was a wall with some small animal cages. There's a fish, lizard, guinea pigs, a bird, which I can't imagine the smell of that place.
Yeah.
And then he leads her into the bedroom. The first thing he says in the bedroom is, I'm going to tell you the rules. The first rule is, I have a gun nearby at all times, and you have to listen to what I say, or there will be consequences. The second rule. You want to guess anything that you think the second rule could be?
Don't speak. Don't say anything.
No. Say something. Call him daddy.
Are you kidding me?
Call him daddy. Vomit.
There's no words.
Vomit. So she's immediately fearing the worst, but oddly, he takes out a pen and paper and starts asking her questions and writing down her answers. He asked how old she was, had she ever had sex before, had she ever used drugs before, what her name was, does she have a boyfriend, just questions about her and her life. But while he's taking notes about her, she was taking notes herself. She noticed there was a big blanket above the bed with a wolf on it, and she's kind of just like memorizing how the bedroom looks. Then her worst nightmare becomes reality. Over the next several hours, this piece of garbage raped her over and over and over again. There was a gun on the nightstand, and while she had thought about grabbing it, this was a grown man, and she was smart. She knew that he would overpower her. After the rapings, they went into the bathroom, and he made her take a shower. While she was in there, because again, observing, she saw hairspray in the bathroom, tampons, a brush with long red hair.
So he has a girlfriend or a wife.
He knew, well, she at least knew that a woman lived there. So, yes, you are correct. After her shower, she sat on the couch with him and, like, kind of tried to have a regular conversation with him, like, so she could put his guard down. And after a while, he said, you know, don't worry, when I'm finished with you, I'm going to take you somewhere that you don't know where you are, but I'll let you go and I'll just leave you there. So he makes her eat dinner with him a bit later, and initially she didn't want to, but he said, look, you're going to have to eat at some point while you're here, and just remember, if you don't, there are consequences if you don't do what I tell you to do. So she's like, okay, I'm going to eat dinner. So she eats dinner, and again, still trying to take his guard down, she asks, can I help you in any way? And he's like, yeah, will you go ahead and sweep the kitchen? Just like playing house.
Yeah, she's smart.
She is smart. So as she's sweeping, she reads the magnets on the fridge, which were like those little free tooth magnets that you get from the dentist office. So she memorized the location and the phone number. He then full from his hearty dinner, and he says, we're going to watch the news now to see if anyone misses you. And of course, this has only been a few hours since her disappearance, so there's nothing so far. Nothing had come up yet, but she's smart and she knew that. She knew that he was just trying to get to her. He took her to the bedroom once again, and he said he had to make a phone call. This asshole says, get back in the tote.
For a phone call?
For a phone call. So she complies, and he puts the gag back in, and she starts having like a full-blown panic attack while she's in there. She's crying, she's trying to breathe, she feels like she's suffocating, and after a bit, he comes back in the room, and she sees like real anger in his face. And he's screaming, why are you in here making noise? She explains what happens. She's still in hysterics, and he's like, oh, I know what will calm you down. He comes back with a pill bottle, and he gives her a pill. He says, here, take this, and here's some Gatorade to wash it down with. So she has no idea what she's taking. She was super out of it the rest of the night. He made her watch a porno with him. He raped her some more, and even though she was only about 30% conscious, she kept repeating these four things to herself. Gather facts. Make him comfortable, wait for him to let his guard down, escape. Bad bitch alert. So he falls, or she falls asleep because she's so high off of something, and she wakes up to a sliver of light creeping through the window. Her rapist is laying beside her, snoring heavily. She knew that this was her moment. It's now or never. So he had put her in handcuffs and tied her feet together with a rope before, like, he went to sleep that night, after she was already asleep. Miraculously, since her hands and wrists were so tiny, She was able to slip her hand out of one cuff, untie her feet, and then finagle out of the other cuff.
Good for her.
He had given her one of his t-shirts to sleep in. She finds her shorts on the floor and quietly pulls them on. She slowly and steadily creeps out of the bedroom, one step at a time. She gets to the front door, and he had, like, shit piled all in front of it. Like, there was a metal accordion closet door, there was a vacuum, just tons of miscellaneous things, and the door was deadbolted. But she got a bolt of adrenaline, and she told herself, look, this is now or never. If you're going to even have a chance of surviving, you're going to have to make noise, but you're going to have to be quick and get the hell out of this hell. She does just that. In record-breaking time, she bolts into the parking lot, goes to the first car she sees, and screams, help, I've been kidnapped. It's two guys in a car, and they're like, whoa, we're not expecting this at 8 a.m. on a Tuesday. What do you want us to do? Like, they literally said, what do you want us to do?
Just take me to the police department, anywhere, come on.
But can you imagine, like, about to get your coffee and go to work, and some girl comes out and says, help, I've been kidnapped. Crazy. So they do take her to the police station, and again, she runs as fast as she can, and the first words out of her mouth are, my name is Kara Robinson, and I was kidnapped and I escaped. They immediately call Kara's mom, and the first thing Kara says to her mom is, mama, come get me. Her dad was obviously thrilled too, and he came and saw her. However, she always used to call him daddy before this.
There's no way she could go back to that.
There's absolutely no way. So when he saw her for the first time, she said, hey, dad. So he knew right then and there it wasn't good. Before her mom arrived at the police station, though, police talked to the two men that brought her in, and they're like, hey, where did you pick her up from? And they tell the police the name of the apartment complex and say, Kara, do you want to help us catch your captor? And she's like, hell yeah, because again, she's a bad bitch. But even with wanting to capture him, I still can't imagine the instant PTSD that sparked within her seeing the complex again. So they do drive to the complex, and at first, you know, all the apartments look the same. And they see a maintenance man on a golf cart. So they figured that he would be a good resource to ask, especially with all the things that she remembered about his apartment, the small animal cages, the wolf blanket, everything. He was a good resource. After Kara described everything to him, he was like, oh yeah, I know that weirdo. Him and his wife live there.
Knew it.
Wifey. So police went in, weapons drawn, and shocking, not shocking, he wasn't there. The officers did, however, notice the dentist magnet, the gun on the nightstand, everything that Kara was saying was true.
And this is great, too, because it validates her story.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, they can't just say, oh, maybe you were just dreaming, or maybe it wasn't him, or something like that. So they also noticed a chest on the ground, and they opened the chest, and they saw some interesting objects in it. Some of these objects were newspaper clippings from the disappearance of Sophia, as well as Kristen and Katie. Also in the chest were panties. Even more not shocking, neighbors said that Richard had, quote, left in a hurry earlier that morning.
Oh, I'm sure he did.
Mm-hmm. So they put on a bolo, a be on a lookout for Richard Ivanitz. They called his wife, who, get this, his wife was in Disney World with Richard's mother and his nephew while this was happening. They took his nephew on vacation. And his wife was completely blindsided. She was like, what? Like, no, you have the wrong number. What? Completely blindsided. So the police do go over to his mom's house to see if he's hiding out there while she's gone. And the green Trans Am was there. Turns out he kidnapped Kara from his mom's car.
That's so sad.
Winner. That is sad. Like, can't even imagine, like, his mom, like, knowing this now. Can't imagine. A few days go by without a trace. Police then reach out to his sister, and although at first hesitant, she eventually complied with the officers. She said that Richard had called her at a hotel in Orlando where she had lived. He called her and wanted to know if she wanted to meet the next day for breakfast at IHOP, which I think is nuts. He knew he was wanted. He knows the police are looking for him, but he wants pancakes that bad.
I mean, he obviously doesn't have any moral code at all.
He just doesn't think.
No.
So police go to this IHOP location, and Richard obviously saw the police presence, so he jets. And the police are like, nah, bro, you're not getting away. So they start chasing him at a high-speed chase, and they call into other officers to help set up, like, those spikes that blow out tires.
Yeah.
And it worked. He spins out, sparks are flying, and he crashes the car. It didn't affect him, though.
I was going to say, did he survive?
Nope. He gets out of the car. He puts a 25 caliber pistol in his mouth, and he pulls the trigger.
All right.
He killed himself right there on the spot, which I think is the most cowardly thing in the world that you can do. Kara says, quote, I felt a little cheated for a moment. I think there was a little something inside of me who wanted this guy to get arrested, who wanted this case to go to trial. I wanted to sit across from him in a courtroom. I wanted him to look at me and know that I was the biggest mistake he had ever made. Choosing me and thinking that I was weak, that was the biggest mistake he had ever made. And I know Kara won't probably ever listen to this, but again, you're a badass bitch, and your pinky toe is stronger than he ever was. And royally fuck him.
I agree. I think we could all learn a couple lessons from her, for sure.
I think so, too. She's a badass. So after this pussy decides to take the easy way out, police decide to look into the chest more to find a connection between, like, him and Sophia, Kristen, and Katie's murders. They had checked his work records versus when the girls were murdered, and he was off every day that they were. But, I mean, that doesn't say anything. They need more proof. Officers tested hair and fibers, found in both cases once again, and they actually matched for real this time. The thing that puts the cherry on the cake for me, though, is they searched Richard's car. They found Kristen's fingerprint in his trunk, plain as day.
Good.
So 5 years after he kidnapped her, he still had not cleaned his damn trunk. Dirty hamster. Like, that's why I said the apartment probably smelled like asshole.
I mean, he's obviously not thinking.
No, obviously not. So Kara believes that if she didn't take the opportunity to escape when she did, that he would have killed her too, which I completely agree.
Yep.
The somewhat happy ending to a tragic story, Kara is now a school resources police officer.
Good for her.
Yeah, she's awesome, and she's a great survivor. There was also a $150,000 reward poster for information leading to the arrest of the murder in all three cases. And the officers gave that reward money to Kara, which snaps to her. She deserves like 100 million times more than what she got. There's no money in the world for what she went through.
I agree.
She is married now. Her name is Sarah Chamberlain. And she has an Instagram that she continues to share and advocate for victims to this day. Her handle is at Kara Robinson Chamberlain, all one word. And you guys can either search it, or we're actually following her on Instagram right now, so you can just go through our followers and type in Kara, and you'll see her. But that is the story of the piece of garbage Richard Ivanitz, but it's really not. It's about the three victims, Sophia, Kristen, Katie, and survivor Kara.
That's a great, great story, and wow.
She's just such a badass.
What an inspirational person, especially at 15 years old.
15 years old. As soon as she got kidnapped, she was reading the serial number inside the tote. She was looking at her surroundings, repeating those four words to herself. Like, how can you... I don't even know what I would do to this day. I never want to imagine it, but...
Right.
Like, would you think to look for all that stuff?
No, I wouldn't. 15
years old. Like, I would just be in panic mode.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she's an inspiration, and I think that's why I got emotional. But there were no tears this time. So, I let them all out last time. So,
well, thank you for that wonderful story.
Yeah. So, you're welcome. And snaps to you, Kara. Again, we love you. So, all right. Well.
If you guys have any questions, comments, concerns, or anything you want us to cover, feel free to message us, direct message us through Instagram.
Our handle, once again, is Colts, Killers, and Cocktails, all one word. And if you have a couple minutes, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. I don't know what other sites you can leave reviews on, but please do it on all sites.
And feel free to subscribe. It helps us out.
Oh, please subscribe. God.
Well, thank you guys, and we'll see you soon.
See you later. Bye.